The Bulls are running in Pamplona. Every morning for 8 days in a row, daredevils from Spain and around the world sprint in front of a pack of bulls. That annual tradition persists despite a growing distaste for bullfighting in Spain. Jerome Sokolowski was there for the start of the bull runs.
The streets of Pamplona are strewn with broken bottles and slick from spilled sangria. The sun has yet to rise, and this northern Spanish city reverberates with the sound of many tongues, including American-accented English.
I stopped drinking about 4 o'clock, so I had to get about a two-hour power nap.
Brian Malizan is a high school teacher from New York.
And this way I'm ready to go. I feel good. I'm sober. I got all my wits, and that's the way I wanted to have it before I do this run.
Around 2,000 runners are crammed into the narrow alleyways that pass for streets in the medieval heart of Pamplona. The runners are dressed in white and wear red bandanas to symbolize the martyrdom of the city's patron saint, Fermín. Malizan says he often talks about the meaning of the festival with his students back home.
It's part of the culture, it's part of the religion, and it's not about the killing of the bull, it's about the whole experience, it's religious. So, you know, it is what it is. We're here to expand our horizons and ourselves as men.
Nearly everyone is male, and many of them do see it as a kind of macho rite of passage. No one knows when the running of the bulls began, but it's been internationally famous since Ernest Hemingway wrote about it in his book, The Sun Also Rises. Animal rights groups say the run torments the bulls, who meet their death later in the day in the bull ring. In the last decade, they've held protests and appear to be winning some sympathy in Spain. Polls show most Spaniards have no interest in bullfighting. And in Catalonia, nearly 200,000 people have signed a petition asking the regional parliament to ban the ritual. Here in Pamplona, some of the Americans admit they're a bit queasy about bullfighting. Jay Quintano is also a New Yorker whose grandparents were from Spain.
I'd rather see this, the running of the bulls, but afterwards I'd rather not kill them.
A bottle rocket marks the opening of the pen and the beginning of the encierro, the 925-yard dash to the bull ring. The encierro can get bloody if a bull strays from the group. 14 people have been killed here in the last century, and many runners are gored. This run was relatively clean. Afterward, Lewis Goldstein and his friends Jim Heaney and Howard Chank feel the heady release of having survived without a scratch.
A lot of buildup for a 10 to 12 second event. So kind of get real geared up, get the adrenaline flowing, and then boom, you start moving, and all of a sudden the bulls are just on you and by you.
Would you guys do it again?
Absolutely. Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, is that so? You'll be here? Or?
No way.
Two of the three of us will.
Cynics would say that the 8 days of round-the-clock insanity and the free-flowing sangria are mostly for the tourists. But plenty of Spaniards say the festival is a vital part of their traditions. Pamplona resident Ramon Moreno has been running with the bulls since he was 13 years old. Yes, it's crazy, he says, but if you've been fed this with your mother's milk, then this is what you do. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Pamplona, Spain.
And if you want to get a look at the running of the bulls, we have a photo gallery for you at npr.org.
And now let's move from that sporting tradition in Spain to an American sports tradition. It's the tradition of denouncing the end of the season in college football. Here's our commentator, Frank DeFord.
As sure as both the politicians and citizens of this republic are unable to agree on much of anything anymore, there is one issue where all decent, God-fearing, right-thinking Americans, from the president himself on down, are of one mind. We all, everyone, are opposed to the college football bowl championship series. Am I right? Honestly, you are more liable to find someone in favor of swine flu than the bowl championship series. Committees in both the House and Senate have recently assembled to excoriate the despised BCS. The Senate Antitrust Committee expressing its misgivings only yesterday. Orrin Hatch, a Republican on that committee, has answered nitpickers who whine that Congress should have better things to occupy themselves by writing that we all know college football is big business, and so just because it's a sport which might be in violation of the Sherman antitrust law, the Senate can't turn a blind eye. Hear, hear. But tell me this, Senator Hatch. Why is it that so many congressmen are so quick to come to the aid of lobbyists for large institutions, universities, but no elected officials ever stand up for the poor laborers in college sport, for university athletes? Because as sure as the BCS is unfair to certain colleges, the NCAA is an evil overseer of its athletic minions. The NCAA invariably sides with athletic departments and coaches, denying student-athletes basic rights and honest remuneration, even as huge sums of money are now made. Precisely the BCS riches that Congress wants colleges to enjoy at the expense of the young performers. Furthermore, now it turns out that the NCAA has sanctioned the use of images of its football and basketball players in video games. The NFL union did likewise, and retired players sued and won more than $26 million. Why shouldn't college athletes deserve the same? Why, too, shouldn't the college stars share in the booming concession sales of things such as the replicas of their uniform jerseys? The answer, well, at least till now, is that in the midst of this billion-dollar business, the NCAA clings to the outdated Victorian concept of amateurism in order to keep powerless athletes, many of them indigent minority, under its thumb. And because amateurism is a sham, the NCAA wittingly underwrites hypocrisy because it knows that athletic department boosters fill the vacuum with illegal under-the-table payoffs. Would that some of those congressmen so keen to help big endowed education and its rich ticket-buying alumni would care as much for the unrepresented poor athlete.
Commentator Frank DeFord stands up for athletes each week from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
As we said, thousands of fans attended the memorial service or crowded outside the Staples Center. Millions around the world tuned in on television at their homes, their workplaces, and some communities even organized viewing events so that Jackson fans could mourn together. We want to talk about why Michael Jackson was such a significant cultural figure. We're going to talk about that with Wesley Morris. He's an entertainment writer for the Boston Globe. He's written about Jackson's meaning, particularly to the African-American community. Also joining us is Harriet Cole. She was the creative director at Ebony Magazine when they published an exclusive December 2007 cover story on Michael Jackson. Also with us is James Peterson. He's an assistant professor of English at Bucknell University who lectures extensively on popular culture. Welcome, all of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to be here.
Hi.
I wanted to ask, Wesley, I'll start with you on this. There was, as I mentioned with Karen, there was some sense that this was going to turn into a spectacle. There was some sense on the talk shows and the cable world. What was this service going to be like? What is your assessment of it as a cultural event?
I was honestly surprised that it had completely dominated all the network coverage. I mean, every news outlet, both on cable and on, you know, basic television had devoted an entire, you know, that entire block of coverage to the memorial. And I think in a lot of ways there's just maybe the sense of public pressure that it did mean something, that many people were going to watch and many people would try to attend. It wasn't a circus. I thought it was a respectful, kind of really enlightening event. I mean, some of it was strange. But I think that as we previously heard from Karen, that there were people who really left that memorial with a sense of a more complex Michael Jackson, both as a cultural figure and as a man.
Harry Cole, let me hear from you, because in your other life, in addition to your work in magazine work, you also write a lot about etiquette and how one should behave at public events and private events. And so I wanted to ask, Harry, what is your sense of this event and how it ties into our assessment of Michael Jackson as a cultural figure?
Well, I would say that, first of all, if you've been to a memorial just for an average person, you normally have the elements that were in this one. They were just produced at a much higher level. but you have the moving spiritual. You have some other person singing a special song. You have a minister preaching and talking about uplifting the life of the person. You, if possible, if someone's able, you have a family member speaking. So I actually think that this was very typical of a memorial, just as would be for Michael Jackson, much, much better produced. I think that the event was incredibly respectful. One of the things that I said yesterday that I'll repeat now is that it felt like a cleansing with Michael's love. You know, all of these elements, the music, the people who spoke, this space with 20,000 people fell silent for more than 15 minutes as they were waiting in the beginning for the event to start. When does that happen? You can't even get people in a classroom to be quiet for 5 minutes. There was a level of respect and reverence for this man, and I think that through from the beginning to the end, what people witnessed, I was watching it on a television monitor, you know, wherever you were watching it, I think that what happened was the beauty, purity, and dynamism of Michael Jackson replaced the negative chatter that has been ongoing since about 2 minutes after he died. Mm-hmm. And that's what a memorial should do. It uplifted him. It shared with the world the creativity, genius, and family and love connection that he had. So I thought it was beautiful and appropriate.
James Peterson, we only have about a minute left. We're going to take a short break and then we'll come back to you. But just your thoughts briefly about the service and how that plays into Michael Jackson's legacy.
Sure, I would agree. It was cathartic, and I think that's why it garnered all the media attention that it did. The catharsis is based upon our need to see Michael Jackson's legacy without all of the trappings of the negative things that we've seen more recently over the last several years. So, but I would say that to say that it's a spectacle is kind of an obvious point. He was a singular figure in African American culture, American popular culture, and the history of music. So to say that his memorial service was a spectacle, of course it is. He's singular. There will be no one like him afterwards. And there was no one like him before.
We need to pause here and take a short break, and we're going to continue our conversation about Michael Jackson's memorial service and his legacy as an entertainment, as a cultural figure, with Boston Globe writer Wesley Morris, Bucknell University professor James Peterson, and Ebony Magazine's Harriet Cole in just a few minutes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking, when there are clouds.
We're leaving you now with one of the moments from the memorial service. We'll be doing that throughout the program. Here's Jermaine Jackson singing his brother's favorite song, Smile.
If you smile with your fear and sorrow, smile, it'll maybe tomorrow. You'll find that life is still worthwhile. If you just light up your face with sadness, hide every trace of gladness all through the years.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a closer look at the media's role in the Michael Jackson coverage. Was it just enough or just too much? And who says? Whose perspective matters on a question like that? That in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to continue our conversation about Michael Jackson, about the memorial service and his musical and cultural legacy. And we're joined by Boston Globe entertainment writer Wesley Morris, Bucknell University professor of English and African American Studies James Peterson, and veteran magazine journalist Harriet Cole of Ebony Magazine. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Great.
I'm going to go on with a clip from Hall of Fame, from NBA Hall of Famer Magic Johnson, who spoke at the memorial service yesterday. Here it is.
I want to thank Michael for opening up so many doors for African Americans to be on daytime shows, late night shows. He allowed Kobe and I to have our jerseys in people's homes across the world because he was already there.
Professor Peterson, what about that? Do you think that's true?
I mean, that's absolutely on point. I spoke with one of my colleagues yesterday who said that when Thriller came out, she went into school and she was like, and this is a white colleague, she said, you know, Michael Jackson was so hot. And one of her friends said, well, he can't be hot, he's black. And that moment for her was kind of that was her first, as a white person, her first sort of encounter with racism. And I told her that's ironic because actually Michael Jackson is responsible for breaking down a lot of those doors. It's interesting because we see his physical transformation, especially people of my generation, is something that's negative. Maybe he was aspiring to be more European looking, but like my daughter who's 8, she drew a picture of Michael Jackson and she drew him in all the stages. So for her, race is kind of already deconstructed, and they, you know, younger people just see him as someone who transformed his artistic persona. So we need to think of it more, I think, in that kind of newer version of Michael Jackson, someone who transcended race and actually deliberately tried to do so. So yes, he broke down a lot of doors, and he did so in such a way that was trailblazing, meaning that there were people who would be able to enter into those spaces after him. So it's quite extraordinary when we think about it.
Wesley Morris, what about that? You wrote about Michael Jackson's kind of shape-shifting, if you will, his kind of racial, mm-hmm. his constant sort of constant manipulation of his appearance. How do you interpret that? What do you think it meant?
I agree with James. I think that in some ways he was someone who transcended race, but I also think he complicated it too. I think he made it something that we had to deal with both as Americans and as African Americans. And I think as African Americans, the thing that we have a hard time turning our backs on Michael Jackson with is that, you know, in a lot of ways his struggle to, you know, his mutation was an extreme version of the historical things that black people have always dealt with in terms of their duality as Americans and exactly. as African Americans. And I mean, you know, a lot of what Michael Jackson did was sort of native to his own psychology. But by extension, I mean, who's to say that with given access to similar, you know, options, wouldn't pursue the same thing? I mean, I wouldn't do that, but I think
many people
from a literary standpoint or from a cultural standpoint, I think that he sort of symbolizes a classic, almost 400-year-old struggle that African Americans mm-hmm. have had in this country. That's
and
really, finally, really
Harriet,
fascinating.
Harriet, finally, yeah. We only have a minute left, but I want to talk to you about one other thing. And when we spoke earlier this year, you talked about one of Michael Jackson's most important identities to himself, and that was of father. And I
yes.
want to play one more clip, which I think many people will agree was probably the most emotionally difficult moment of the service, when his daughter mm-hmm. unexpectedly spoke. And this is what she had to say.
Ever since I was born, Daddy has been the best father you could ever imagine. And I just wanted to say I love him so much.
Harriet, it
makes you choke up every time.
It does. Mm-hmm. And finally, Harriet, you have the last word here. How do you think Michael Jackson will be remembered?
Well, it's funny. I talked to Ramon Bain, who was his previous manager. We're doing a special book and magazine about Michael. And what she said to me just the other day is people say that they're going to remember Michael for his catalog of music and his entertainment value. And she said the way that he tended to those children and loved them up is really going to be what he's remembered by, because they will become such great beings in the world. And what parent doesn't want to be remembered that way? I mean, that is the most incredible gift that a parent can receive in life or after. So that he was such a loving parent and had the opportunity to shepherd these children for as long as he did, we will see what a blessing it is for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Harriet Cole is creative director at Ebony Magazine. She joined us from Chicago. I was also pleased to be joined by Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. He joined us from Boston. And James Peterson is an assistant professor of English and Africana Studies at Bucknell University. He joined us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's easy to forget now, But it all began in the small city of Gary, Indiana, where steel mills dominated the local economic landscape. It's been decades since the Jackson family lived in Gary, but local politicians there are doing their best to remind the world of Jackson's birthplace. We're joined now on the phone by the mayor of Gary, Indiana, Rudy Clay. Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You graduated from Roosevelt High School, as I understand it, the same school attended by the older Jackson brothers. What was the reaction in Gary when the Jackson Five made it big? Do you remember?
Well, proud, number one. We were proud, you know, because we are the children that was raised with Michael Jackson. And our pride and our love for Michael Jackson is unrelenting, should I say.
What's been the reaction to the news of his passing?
Well, our hearts are heavy, and in Gary, Indiana, extremely heavy. Just tears just pouring out of our hearts because Michael Jackson, there was love here for him. And and after the Los Angeles memorial yesterday, it's been just a real somber feeling around the city because we love Michael. We've known him. In fact, a friend of mine said the other day, so I knew Michael before he graduated from kindergarten. So Michael is our favorite son.
You think he still remembers you? You remember him?
Oh, absolutely. You know, well, gee whiz, they had a song. It said 2300 Jackson Street, always home. So there's no place like home, and Gary, Indiana is the home of Michael Jackson. The home, in fact, at 2300 Jackson Street, you're only talking about 24 feet by 28 feet house where Joe Jackson, the father, raised 9 children. I mean, and then went on to become the greatest entertaining family in the world. And, of course, Michael went on to become the greatest entertainer in the world. That's quite an accomplishment.
You've told a number of people that you would like the family to consider interring Michael's remains in Gary. And, you know, those remarks haven't been universally applauded. But would you just tell us again why you think that would be a good idea?
Well, actually, what we really did was said to the family that in Gary, Indiana, the red carpet is out for anything that the family would like to do. Actually, what we did is ask them to allow them to lay in state in Gary, Indiana, but we respect whatever the decision that the family make on that issue. But we want them to know, because another song that Michael made, "Where There Is Love, I'll Be There," and there's love for Michael right here in Gary, Indiana. So we just put the red carpet out, and but we respect whatever the decision that the family make, because in the final analysis, it's their decision.
And finally, Mr. Mayor, I've been asking pretty much all of our commentators to reflect on this. What do you think Michael Jackson's legacy will be? I mean, so much happened between when he was born there and where he ended up, and the sort of the worldwide journey, all the personal travails. How do you think Michael Jackson will be remembered?
You know, I think Michael will be remembered as an individual that brought people together. No matter where you go in the world, you can go to the deep heart of Africa, to the highest part of Alaska. You can go to Jackson, Mississippi, Cleveland, Ohio, China, Japan, anywhere in the world. They know Michael Jackson as a person, as a humble person with a good heart and love in his heart. I think he will be remembered as a person who has the love to bring people together all over the world, no matter. And that's what makes us so proud of him and Gary. He put Gary on the map. Anywhere we go in the world, if we say that we are from Gary, Indiana, they will say that is the home of Michael Jackson. So Michael put us on the world map, so we can't forget that.
Rudy Clay is the mayor of Gary, Indiana, the birthplace of Michael Jackson. He was kind enough to join us from his home there. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We've been having conversations about Michael Jackson's memorial service and his legacy. Now a look at how all that has been handled by the media. Millions of Americans have tuned into the coverage that followed Jackson's death on the talk shows, the specials, and the Los Angeles memorial service held yesterday. But others say enough already, that they have reached their limit of tearful tributes from fans and celebrity admirers, that it has passed time. It is long past time for the media to look away. Lisa Demoreis is one of them. She's a media critic for The Washington Post. She's written about the Jackson coverage. Also with us is Carol Doherty. He's the associate director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. And they recently released a survey of how Americans felt about the Michael Jackson coverage. They're both with us now. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be
here.
You're
welcome.
Now, Lisa, it sounds like you were over it a while ago. In fact, let me just read the first line from your piece that you published on Tuesday. In Tuesday's Washington Post, you said, "The Michael Jackson memorial orgy of excess has arrived." You noted that there were some elephants parading near the Staples Center who were due to come to the circus, which was being held there later this week. And you said that that was appropriate because that's, in fact, what this was. But come on now. A much-loved artist, a global superstar, was it really so wrong?
Well, no, not at all. You're mistaking my calling it an orgy of excess. You're mistakenly thinking that I think that's a bad thing.
Ah,
and
I
don't at all. I love orgies of excess.
I see. Okay.
I think that what the press was doing was what the public wanted to watch based on the numbers. So I don't think they're actually going to step away from this now. I think this will continue until we get the toxicology reports at least.
Okay, but you said I got it wrong, but you said now the freak show, and then you listed all the coverage.
Right.
So
well, yes.
Well, I don't know, it seems to me that
that's what TV does best. Excess is what we love, excess in this country. And television is great at providing people with that. And I thought that TV actually really stepped up to the plate on this story.
Did you watch the service yourself, the memorial?
I did.
And what was what's your take on it as a media event, and also as a public memorial? Did it match the subject at hand?
I actually thought it was terrific. I was surprised that there were no big glitches, given how little time they had to put this together. I think that's undoubtedly because AEG, the people who are working on his concert, and other people who are professionals at putting on shows, were involved in this memorial service. And I really thought it came off. There were very few glitches.
And Carol, I haven't forgotten about you. One more question for Lisa before we turn to you. Michael Jackson's brother Marlon spoke at the memorial service yesterday. He was one of the final speakers before Michael's daughter spoke. I just want to play a short clip of what he said. Here it is.
"We would never understand what he endured, not being able to walk across the street without a crowd gathering around him, being judged, ridiculed. How much pain can one take? Maybe now, Michael, they will leave you alone."
I'm asking you to speculate, Lisa. Well, who do you think he was talking to? Do you think in part he was talking to the media? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's entirely what he's talking about. And that is the downside of becoming as big a phenomenon as Michael Jackson was. I mean, when you're getting back to the point of, do you think the media has done too much? And I believe not at all. This is a man who had a profound influence, for better or for worse, on music, on dance, and on fashion. And there are very few people that you can say that about. This man was enormously important to our pop culture. And the bad side of that is that, yes, you end up getting stalked by paparazzi, and particularly when you start doing things like he did to his face, and that becomes the subject. And I'm sure that was very difficult.
Carol, you have some numbers on this. You actually polled on this last week, and there are also some new numbers. What did the Pew poll find about how closely Americans are following this story, and how do they feel about the coverage?
Well, clearly it was a top story from the public's perspective last week. No surprise there, and it remains that way this week, even though the news to date before the funeral, you know, has just been a continuing story. But they also see that the coverage has been too much. 64% say too much coverage, as you might expect. People are drawn to it, yet they also see it as excessive.
And there was an interesting racial and age breakdown in reaction to this. Tell us about that.
Well, that's pretty surprising. I mean, we see Jackson as a crossover figure, but African-Americans, at least initially, were far more interested than whites. 80% of blacks said they followed it very closely, compared with 22% of whites. And whites were also more likely than blacks to say too much coverage.
You said, in fact, more than half of African Americans, 54%, said the amount of coverage has been about right, compared to 25% of whites. 7 in 10 whites say there's been too much coverage, compared with 36% of blacks. What do you make of that, Carol? And Lisa, I'm curious about your reaction as well.
Well, I think it's a big story for whites, but it's a mega story for African Americans. I think that there was an element there that this was a real icon, and that, you know, people were expressing that.
Lisa, what's your take on this? And I've noted that in the Post and in other media outlets, there have been a number of pieces written by African Americans about how deeply African Americans felt about Michael Jackson's death, even as they're expressing ambivalence about what they perceived as his shifting racial identity over the years. What's your take on this?
Well, you know, I think that the numbers to really look at are the numbers that are going to come out today, and that's the ratings. And you can get demographic information as well about who watched, what age group they were, what ethnic group they were. I think, speaking to the poll, that when people are watching in the kinds of numbers that they have been watching, that speaks louder than polling. If people are watching, it's because they're interested. And when we talk about excess, this is an era of hundreds of television channels. This is an era where we have multiple news channels. The good news about news channels is that you're going to be able to get the news exactly when you want it, not at 6:30 when the broadcast network does its evening newscast. And the bad news about these networks is that they have to fill 24/7. And to suggest that they're overdoing it means that you're watching too much. These channels are available to tune in when you need to, when you want to, and have the time to tune in. But to fault cable news networks for being on this story so incessantly is to not really understand the nature of the beast.
Carol made the point that we see Michael Jackson as this huge crossover figure, a racial crossover figure, artistically and in the entertainment world, and yet it seems to me that the interest in this seems polarized, at least according to what people are telling these researchers. Lisa, is that common these days for viewing to be so polarized, for people, blacks and whites, to have very different opinions about what is worth seeing and talking about?
You know, it's interesting because about once a year, the Nielsen Company, which is the number crunching company for the TV industry, will put out a top 10 list of shows in white households and in African American households. And there is crossover, but there are also a lot of shows that are very different. A show that is very popular with African American viewers is not watched in the same numbers by white viewers. Football, when football was on ABC, it was always the number one show. But shows that were, for instance, black cast comedies tended to have a large African American audience, but a much smaller white audience. And there are some shows, some scripted shows, that managed to sort of unite the viewing audience. And those were the shows that really succeeded in this country. And everybody always harkens back to The Cosby Show, which was one of the greatest examples that was watched by white families and black families alike in very large numbers.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the media coverage of Michael Jackson's death and his memorial service. We're speaking with Washington Post TV columnist Lisa DeMorais and Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center. Carol, what about Lisa's earlier point that, you know, maybe our viewers and listeners protest too much, that although the findings say that a majority of Americans overall say that they've had enough of this story, the ratings have been astounding.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think those things are kind of incompatible. I think people, again, you know, they are tuning in large numbers, in part because it's unavoidable, frankly. I mean, you can't.
I don't know. There are books. Forgive me. I'm sorry.
Well, no,
it's
no,
not
no.
unavoidable.
No, but our research shows that 70%
some nice
of Americans.
CDs I could recommend.
Right. 70% of Americans get their news from television. And if you watched cable or even network, especially the morning shows lately, you've been getting basically nothing but Michael Jackson. So there's some of that. And I think. But people also can be drawn to the story and yet see it as just too much coverage.
Is there any way you can tell from your data whether the people who say that it's too much are still watching it?
Oh, I think that a certain number, a good number of people who say it's too much are watching it. I think that's pretty clear.
Final thought, Lisa, from you. We've talked a lot on this program, and many people are writing about the dilemma that the so-called mainstream journalism finds itself in. On the one hand, people constantly criticize the media for being celebrity-driven, and yet you've got a cultural figure like this who's very important to a number of people, who did make news in a number of ways, whose own personal life seemed to reflect a lot of the identity struggles, gender bending, racial shape-shifting, all of that that a lot of people were experiencing in their own lives, albeit in an extreme way. In this kind of an environment, is there any way that serious media could afford not to cover this?
I think it would have been irresponsible of them not to cover it, because I don't think that our culture is an unimportant subject. Getting back to your other point about people who say there's has been too much Jackson coverage but still watching, this is not just when you turn on the news getting inundated because you want to hear about what's going on overseas and you're stuck listening to Michael Jackson stories. You look at the Michael Jackson specials that the broadcast networks did the day of his death and shortly after his death, and those shows did some of the biggest numbers that broadcast TV has done all summer, and some of the biggest numbers that any television has done that summer. And these are not people who are tuning in because they want to hear some other news story and are suffering through the Michael Jackson material. These are specials about Michael Jackson that people are tuning into by the millions.
Lisa DeMorais is a columnist for The Washington Post. Carol Doherty is the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. They were both kind enough to join us from their respective offices in Washington, D.C. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Those confirmation hearings come in the same summer as Congress works to overhaul the health care system. Although one segment of the population is not being discussed in Congress, there's no proposal to cover the nation's estimated 11 million illegal immigrants. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on the political and economic questions involved.
Of the estimated 46 million uninsured, a good 20% are foreign-born non-citizens. In fact, this has been the fastest-growing segment of those without insurance. But figuring out how many in this group are illegal immigrants and what's spent on them is tough.
This is something you have to estimate. Nobody sat down and just tallied this up.
John Shields is with the Lewin Group, a nonpartisan health care consulting firm. He says surveys about insurance don't ask legal status, but an array of analysts have extrapolated a best guess.
Well, we've estimated about 6.1 million of the uninsured are actually undocumented.
That's only about half the total population of undocumented. Shields says many illegal immigrants use false documents to work on the books with regular tax deductions and benefits.
And a lot of those people are getting employer health benefits as part of their compensation.
A spokesman with America's Health Insurance Plans says it's possible that individual insurance companies could check for legal status, but employer-provided coverage is vetted at the workplace. If a fake ID can get you a job, it can also get your family health insurance. In fact, Shields says this is something lawmakers might want to consider as they craft legislation aiming for near universal coverage.
If you design the plan improperly, you actually would wind up taking away their insurance and creating new uninsured people.
But what about those illegal immigrants who today don't have health insurance? Some estimate 6 million people, others about 8 million. That is still a sizable chunk. How much health care do they use each year?
The economics aren't as great as they've been made out to be.
Paul Fronston is with the Employee Benefit Research Institute. He says illegal immigrants are younger and so generally healthier than the overall population. And studies show they go to the doctor far less than the native-born. Their share of the healthcare system is minuscule.
We're talking about 1% or 2% of what we spend on healthcare, which, keep in mind, is over $2 trillion now.
That 1% or 2% includes those who are insured or those who pay out of pocket. A small slice, but still about $1 billion, is paid for by Emergency Medicaid. That's a federal program that covers emergency care for patients who can't prove their legal status. Analyst John Shields of the Lewin Group estimates about $5 billion in care for the undocumented is uncompensated in any way. He says that's a blip on the national health care system, some 0.2%. But it can hurt when it falls disproportionately, say, on hospitals along the southern border.
Some hospitals have had to cut back services to their community at large because they have to absorb the added costs.
Carla Lugero is with the American Hospital Association, and she's seen more and more hospitals face the burden of caring for illegal immigrants in the past decade. Some have had to raise fees. Others qualify for extra federal subsidies if they have an especially large number of Medicare or Medicaid patients. Lugero says this can be a way to indirectly cover part of the cost of caring for the undocumented.
So although those programs do not reimburse for the care of undocumented and uninsured individuals, collectively we as society do end up bearing that cost.
Lugero says if Congress does not include illegal immigrants in any health plan, hospitals will look for those federal payments to continue. Peter Harbage of the Center for American Progress says health care for the undocumented is as much a political question as an economic one. No one wants to subsidize primary care for those with no right to be in the country. Yet it's accepted that emergency care will be provided.
And so some of those dollars maybe were used up front, you could have a more efficient system.
But Harbage says that's not a conversation Congress wants to have right now. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.